Ghostbusters!
This is the Sarcastic Voyage Podcast. Episode 47 on the subject of Ghostbusters, featuring Ron Algar Watt, Matt Robotham, and Adrian Bochnivsky. Need an original piece of art? Ever fancy being drawn? Well, Pat Loika can make it happen. Pat's rates are affordable and satisfaction is guaranteed. Mention this ad and get 20% off your first order. For samples of Pat's work, see the covers of Sarcastic Voyage episodes 13, 36, 47, and 48, or listen to these Pat's testimonials from satisfied customers. Pat's testimonials? Did Matt write this?
I'm the genius creator of an acclaimed podcast. Pat Loika has drawn me as a Ghostbuster, a member of the Justice League, well, a Justice League, and he's even depicted me in those tiny shorts our voice guy obsesses over for some reason. Thanks, Pat!
He took one of the most painful, embarrassing moments of my life and captured it perfectly on paper. Thanks bunches, Pat Loika.
Send all inquiries to patloika@gmail.com. That's P-A-T-L-O-I-K-A. Panel discussion.
Hi, Dix. Here we are. Matt's here, as always. And with us this time is Adrian Bochnivsky. Adrian, thanks for coming back.
Yeah, look how you've grown. You're such a big boy now. And
we're still not too big to bring back our friends, though. Also you.
No, I meant that as just, you know, he's growing and you're looking good, too, you know.
We're eating well.
After we left that night.
Hey! Don't make me have to edit this out now. We are here, of course, to do the last of the theme shows because you guys don't appreciate us. We're doing one more because we have to.
The greatest of them all.
Yeah, the one time Matt finally does some homework.
I did all the homework.
Really? You want me to watch Ghostbusters? Well, all right. And the nice thing is Adrian actually went and did a ton of stuff as well, and I went and crammed a bit, so we are full of obscure facts.
And I just have to lead off the show, and Matt, I'm guessing, will completely agree with me. For years, and even still today, and you probably, you know, we discussed this a little in pre-show, Al, that you probably don't feel this way because you were a little bit older. To me, Ghostbusters was not just a movie. It was a career option.
Oh, fuck.
Oh, Matt's mentioned that on the show more than once.
It is a career option in my future, and I am going to become a Ghostbuster.
Now, see, you guys were born, like, the year before it came out, so, I mean, this was pretty much always in your field of experience. You know, you always had a life with Ghostbusters in it. I was, like, what, 8 or 9 when it came out, and for some reason I didn't see it in the theater, and it didn't... It wasn't on HBO or whatever. I didn't see it for years and years. So, I mean, it just was completely outside of my whole experience. It was very strange. I didn't see it till I was 16 or 17. And, you know, I loved it. But
wow.
I mean, that's one of my first memories. When I was 2.5 and we bought Ghostbusters on VHS, bring it home. And I was so fucking excited.
You lived a much less sheltered life than I did. I didn't get to actually watch the Ghostbusters movie until I was well into elementary school. It started just with the cartoon.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And then sort of like eventually the movie, like I saw the movie in like a video store when I was with my dad there one time. I'm like, Dad, they made a Ghostbusters movie. Oh, yeah, I've seen that. No, Dad, I want to get this. No, we're getting, what was it? Major League 2.
Nice. Take that, Bacula. For some reason, I didn't see it for years. And it was one of those deals where we were at the video store. I was in high school. I was with a bunch of my friends. And, you know, I get the smack in the back of the head. You haven't seen it? What the fuck, man? And so I quickly made up for that. And honestly, I can say this and Back to the Future are the two sort of quintessential for me. Like, I can't think of movies that are made like this anymore. The sort of sci-fi comedy, like just powerhouses.
Yeah, they it's really sort of a genre they don't work with anymore.
No, and it's kind of disappointing.
That it's so weird that it is sci-fi, because you describe Ghostbusters as a sci-fi movie. They're like, no, it's a comedy.
Well, but
it's such a sci-fi movie. Like,
oh yeah,
they take the approach that ghosts can be explained with science, and you know everything that they do has, you know, plausible, like, within the story, you know, reasons behind it. Mm. And so it's very much science fiction.
Well, that's all Dan Aykroyd, because, you know, even now he's even weirder about it. But even then, he was interested in it.
Well, sure. And I suppose if we're going to start and try to move sort of chronologically, that's definitely a thing we should talk about. You guys know way more about this than I do. Dan Aykroyd apparently started with this just fuck
the
ton
weirdest
of...
weirdest fucking idea for a movie.
Yeah.
Go ahead, man.
Dan Aykroyd had a dream about him and John Belushi chasing ghosts through parallel universe with wands while wearing SWAT gear.
With wands.
With wands. Yeah, there was that too, I think.
Well, I know I've read the treatment or whatever.
Ghost Smashers.
Yes.
I've read the treatment or whatever, but it's been quite a while. It's not off the top of my head now, but... I just remember reading this and saying in 1984 or whenever they would have shot this, 82, 83, this would have been completely unfilmable. It just seemed so ambitious, especially for a comedy.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, that's what kills me, is that there are only like two books about like the making of it, and they're both out of print. That's something I'd really like to see, because I've seen a couple of like the behind the scenes with like the Stay Puft figure like above the Model City and stuff, and that's just awesome to me. And I would have not enough of that. They didn't have, I mean, for all the street, I mean, for, obviously for the 55, what is it? I don't know the address of the firehouse. But,
55, fuck.
You're getting a little too inside for me on that one.
Hold on, we're gonna just get inside and show you.
All right, well, so the people don't have to sit and wait for you to think of that.
Yeah, it's 55 Central Park West.
Okay.
Yeah. I
mean, so you had permits and stuff for that, but like, all of the driving around scenes were shot without permits.
And we should mention, like, little back up a step here. Not everyone knows, when you film in New York City, you can't just point a camera and go. You need special permission from, it's like the New York Film Board, and you need a permit.
Mm-hmm.
And
they're shooting all these scenes with this car with sirens going that's not an emergency vehicle going full speed. And, you know, obviously the famous shot in Rockefeller Center where you can actually see the security guard chasing after them in the background.
Right.
You know, it's part of one of the best, in my opinion, one of the best film montages of all time.
Oh, yeah.
What is that when they first, like, get up to speed and there's just, like, that whole...
They're running around, they're going to Chinatown and stuff.
Right, right.
You got Larry King, Ghosts and Ghostbusters.
Well, and that's something Adrian pointed out that I didn't even realize is the connection to, you know, people we've kind of focused on our show.
Yeah, and Larry King, of course, is the fucking like, oh, are these guys for real? Are they the cause of it? You're like, fuck you! But then our boy Casey Kasem, he comes out and he talks about how they're just, you know, what was the line?
Boy showed up and took out some pesky poltergeists and then stayed to dance the night away.
Thank you, Dr. Girlfriend.
That was terrible.
But yeah, that was...
But yeah, you know, like I was saying in the pre-show, like, to be there, like, in that city, and just... There was just so many... There's also so many shots of just these massive crowds.
Mm-hmm.
Like, at Spook Central, at the courthouse, when they're doing the arm... Or with the army trucks and everything.
Sure.
It's just insane for this film that's like... If you told somebody what this film was about, it's about these four guys who put on these nuclear accelerators and bust ghosts.
Yeah.
Whatever that.
Like, so they're exterminators? Yeah.
It's about Dan Aykroyd going completely fucking bonkers after Belushi died and coming up with this unfilmable movie. Oh, okay.
Well, and then, like, when you look at the original cast list, this was going to be the... like comedy film of the decade.
Well, I do remember Eddie Murphy was supposed to be Winston, but who else do we have?
Eddie Murphy was supposed to be Winston. John Candy was supposed to play Lewis.
Oh, right, right.
Paul was supposed to be in it as Gozer.
Who's that?
Paul Rubens, Pee Wee.
Ah, right, okay.
Yeah. There was a huge list of people they wanted for Egon.
Yeah, really? And then Harold Ramis, you know, obviously the story is that he ended up playing it because he was the one who sounded most like the character, even though he
was.
Right.
But, you know, and it's funny to me that, and, you know, obviously Eddie Murphy, if Eddie Murphy was in it, the film would be probably bigger than it was, but he made decision it made. Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I can't imagine the script as it existed, you know, in like the final shooting script being Eddie Murphy. Like, you have to humble up a lot to be Winston. I mean, he mm-hmm. did okay in that first movie. Like, he was, you know, he was the outsider. He's the one. You got a lot of exposition in that third act. You got a lot of stuff you got to get the audience up to speed with. And it's great to bring in sort of an everyman to kind of stand there and ask the questions, you know?
Because they couldn't get
Murphy. Right. But I mean, narratively, I think that works better.
Oh, yeah.
I agree. That's a big reason Bill Murray for years didn't want to do a lot of these movies, because he felt Ernie Hudson should get more screen time. And I agree, because I think he does a good job as the character.
However, I mean, I we'll get to Ghostbusters 2 more in a minute, but that was one of my big complaints about Ghostbusters 2 was Ernie Hudson, Winston is no longer the outsider. He's no longer the guy who just got hired, who can ask the questions and get us up to speed. Now he's right, supposed to be part of the team, and they still didn't have very much for him to do.
Yeah, what do you have him do then?
Right.
Well, and that was the problem. Well, and we'll get to there. We'll talk more about that in Ghostbusters 2. But sure. I still think he's a, you know, a solid character. And, you know, he does have that little monologue where he talks about shit'll make you. I've seen shit'll
white. Shit make you white.
Oh, all the comedy lines that they gave him. You know, he sold. I mean, he was there.
They have that really great scene with him and Ray in the car where they talk about the end of the world.
Yeah.
And it's funny because it's this very, you know, funny movie. This very, you know, nonstop humor, and then they have this very somber sort of.
Yeah, that's one of the few points where it really slows down for a minute, and it's like, ooh, yeah, hey.
Like, yeah, this is the end of everything. And, like, they also talk about in a lot of these stories of when they made Stay Puft that they were worried it was going to look too goofy.
Well,
it does look, but I think that's why it's awesome, is that it's
like,
horrifically, like, the end of the world is going to come at this.
Right. Mm. Well, and but I think. I think that's a line that movie walked very carefully, and so looking at the pre-production, looking at all the ways that it could have screwed up, it's amazing that it came together the way it did, and it perfectly walks that line between you believe the stakes, you believe the world's going to end, but at the same time you're laughing, and not a lot of movies can pull that off.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they really made you laugh, and they also made you believe the fantastic stuff at the same time.
And I think, you know, Reitman tried it again with Evolution.
Yeah, that was a shame.
I didn't see that. I didn't actually even realize that was Reitman.
I was really excited about it. I thought it had real potential, and it just...
I tell you, to a lesser extent, and I would not put it anywhere near the level of classic, but I would say the only thing I can think of that sort of walked that line somewhat successfully was, like, Men in Black.
Yeah, that was another one that sort of tried to get to sort of capture that spirit.
Right.
Yeah, and then it had a terrible second film. So
right.
You're exactly right.
Well, technically, it just had the same first film.
Yeah. But, I mean, really, that's one of the only few other movies I can think of that...
That sort of sci-fi, that sort of blend of sci-fi and comedy.
It's not even just the blend of sci-fi and comedy. It's getting you to take it seriously and be able to laugh at the same time, because it's so easy to stray into parody and farce and just, like you say, laugh at the Stay Puft or whatever. But the way they wrote it, you actually take it seriously, and it looks silly.
That's the thing. Like, making him funny is easy. Making him a genuine threat's a little more difficult.
Right.
Right. And that, like, the whole film is like that, where it's on the level of how serious do we go with this? And then, you know, it walks a fine line on multiple points. You also have the humor, which they didn't want to make it too adult.
Right. Mm.
At the same time, they wanted it to be funny for everybody, not just kids.
Mm.
And I think that was a major reason for success. I mean, like, the original line was something like, the Burn in Hell Bankman was actually something else, but Burn in Hell Bankman is so fucking funny to me. Like, I don't know why, but it just cracks me up every time.
There were a few lines, I caught bits and pieces of it before I finally actually watched it. And I actually thought it was more of an adult movie, because I would catch things like, are you, Alice, menstruating right now? And, you know, not knowing what that was, I'm like, this is for grown-ups, I guess.
Ray getting his ghost blowjob.
Right.
I swear to God, I did not know what that scene was for years.
Well, I didn't either, and I was just like, that's kind of, my mom was always really embarrassed during it. I'm like, why? Ray's just undressing.
The ghost is helping him undress.
Yeah. I want to see the deleted scenes of that, because the original thing is that they go to a castle. Like, somehow Ray gets, it's not a dream sequence, it actually happens to Ray. Where
they go to a castle in New York.
We have sex with a ghost. And I'm like, what? How does this even happen?
Okay, so what else, like, in the original script?
That's
like,
why they kept Slimer around.
what else in the original script was that ridiculous? I mean, I there must be more in that original treatment that was just that.
I've never really read the original. Unfortunately, I've never read the original treatment.
No, me neither. I just know, like, stuff I've heard about it.
And we'll do a little research after we're finished recording here, and if it's floating around out there, we will put it in the show notes, but I'm not positive it's out there.
Like,
so
speaking of ridiculous, like, John Candy was ridiculous. Like, he wanted Lewis to speak in a thick German accent and have wiener dogs and just be this, like, ridiculous character, and then he got mad because they wouldn't let him do it, and that's why he quit.
So basically what we're learning is that Ghostbusters was, like, a fraction away from being a complete disaster.
That's what I've always felt, that it could have gone wrong so many ways, and I don't know if it was Reitman or who, but somebody stepped in and
was a huge he brought the whole sort of like working class feel to the movie.
Well, it feels like somebody just grabbed all the good elements and said, okay, we need to get this under control. We can't let the comedy spin off. We can't let this happen. We got to just hammer this out, make it make sense. And was it him?
Matt's right. That's all Reitman, because Aykroyd wanted it to be, they're traveling through space and you know,
time, and they have a magic flying car.
Yeah, dude, this is 1983 when we're filming this. We can't afford that.
Not only that they couldn't afford it, like, I mean, that was a big part of it, but his is just so fucking, like, he wants it to be on the spiritual level.
Right.
Because Dan Aykroyd really believes ghosts exist.
Yeah, and I've heard his whole spiel. He really believes all that, God, I don't know, the Bermuda Triangle and Loch Ness Monster and all that goofy shit. Like, he's really into that stuff.
Dan Aykroyd has webbed toes.
All right, then.
Just throwing that out there.
Okay. I am of the opinion, I have always been of the opinion, that Dan Aykroyd worked really well with Belushi. And when Belushi died, Aykroyd had a little bit left in him, and then he just kind of petered out. Like, he needed that influence to really bring out his greatness.
Well, I think that's because he worked with Bill Murray.
Yeah, that makes sense. And Bill Murray definitely grounded that movie. I mean, it was, you know, like, he brought a lot of humor to it, but it was a lot of very, you know, down-to-earth type, just kind of wry, you know.
Well, and I mean, can you imagine anyone else playing that character? Like, Bill Murray is fucking Pete Venkman.
It's hard at this point to, you know, to second-guess that. Like, a year after I'd seen it, I might have been able to ponder that question, but it's just too hard to separate now.
What I enjoy is, well, I mean, I enjoy the film, obviously.
But, sure.
Like, the one thing I enjoy about the film
is the film.
Yeah.
The whole thing.
Yes.
It's a perfect movie.
It really is. Like, writing, no, really, just from a writing standpoint, and I said this about Back to the Future as well, it's one of those scripts that just, there's not a slow moment, there's not a moment where either a joke or an important piece of exposition is happening. It's just it's written so, like, tight.
It's got just these perfect moments. I mean, the entire sequence in the Sedgwick Hotel is just, it's just so awesome.
And that's very classic, going back. Like, that makes me think of the Marx Brothers.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Unlike the original thing, they wanted to have Winston show up earlier and get slimed by Slimer. But it works so much better when you have Venkman, because even though he's a, you know, fun character, he is obnoxious.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's only funny if the Yutz has dignity.
Right. You know, just to see him get served up like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's right here, Ray.
It's looking at me.
I mean, and like a lot of the line, you know, a lot of the best lines, you know, has been told are improv. But I think it's when you work with some of the, you know, best cast members of Saturday Night Live and, you know, Matt's favorite show, SCTV, that's what.
Yeah. and you're catching those guys at their prime too. Like, I mean, if you'd gotten those guys together in the mid '90s, it would have been too late. But coming right off Saturday Night Live or a couple of years later, they're still young and fresh and kind of funny. It was definitely a good dynamic.
Mm-hmm. You know, the things I love are like just the little things. You know, Janine goes on and on about what she likes to read.
Oh yeah,
and he comes up and he goes, "Print is dead."
Yeah,
it just cracks me up every time.
There's actually a moment in the Ghostbusters, the real Ghostbusters, the animated series, and we'll get to that more in detail in a minute, where there's a librarian hitting on Egon. And she basically says all the things that Janine should have said in that scene. You could tell whoever wrote it with that in mind. And she even mentions, I have a perfume that's, it's eau de fungus. And it's like the writers are thinking, oh, well, if Janine had done this instead of this and this instead of this, maybe she would have grabbed him. You know, it was just a nice little nod.
And, you know, you're right about the working element, because it's hard to distinguish whether it's a blue – it's not really a blue-collar movie, because these guys are all supposed to be super intelligent. Because you do have these doctors, you know, these theoretical doctors of science. Mm. It's just running around.
Well, I mean, they're basically exterminators.
Yeah. And that's – it's so great.
Mm. Well, and they make a point of showing you that in the movie when they go get their loan, and when Ray's kind of, you know, I've been in the private sector. They expect results. You know, you really get that feeling of an ivory tower, you know, like someone who's never had a job before, like having to go work for a living. And then the transition is just so, you know, stark.
What's funny is that you can definitely tell Venkman's doing it because he's got nothing else to do. He just got kicked out of Columbia.
Yeah. Mm.
Whereas Egon's doing it as a pursuit of scientific knowledge, and Ray's doing it because he fucking loves it.
Yeah, it's fun.
You know, Matt is Ray. He does it because he fucking loves this job.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then, well, I'm looking here at Wikipedia, you know, the greatest source for anything on the planet.
Absolutely.
Egon Spengler was cast originally by Chevy Chase, Michael Keaton, Christopher Walken, John Lithgow, Christopher Lloyd, and Jeff Goldblum. Originally read for it. So, I mean, and all of those names in the 80s are massive names.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the thing, is I can kind of picture quite a few of those pulling it off. Maybe not as well as Harold Ramis did. Mm. But
well, here's what's funny. Christopher Lloyd goes on to play wacky mad scientist Doc Brown.
Well, right. but at the same time.
I slipped, fell on a toilet, and suddenly it appeared for me, the proton pack.
But I mean, you need someone deadpan for that, first of all. I don't know, Christopher Lloyd has a deadpan bone in his body. But at that point, I sound fucking crazy saying this, but Chevy Chase at that point was the go-to guy for deadpan stuff, really.
Yeah, I like the idea of Jeff Goldblum as well, because the Brundle fly being a Ghostbuster just makes me
That would be pretty awesome.
Absolutely, they probably did that episode in the animated series. That sounds like something they would have done. But yeah, just as far as I mean, that movie goes, I usually when I watch a comedy from that period, unless it's Back to the Future, it's like, okay, now is the lull. Now is the obligatory stupid second act where they invent some kind of peril, blah, blah, blah. And I usually kind of wander off. Ghostbusters, I don't have one moment where I'm not interested.
Yep.
Right, because the second act starts with that montage.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's like, holy shit, this is awesome.
And you're seeing
all these great, you know, newspaper and magazine covers that are just fantastic.
And that's
you
such
know how
a...
much I would give for that Life cover?
Oh, no kidding.
When I was a kid, I was like, man, I should read The New Yorker. I was like, The New Yorker had that Ghostbusters thing. I looked for it for years thinking it was real. The New Yorker had the Ghostbusters cover, thinking that, of course, they're going to have the cover with the Ghostbusters on it.
Well, yeah, it can't be fake. I mean, come on. Yeah.
A real magazine.
But
that's,
I mean,
a leak, isn't it?
I mean, it's such a kind of a cliche, kind of a hacky thing, even by that point. Oh, look, here's newspaper headlines to show you what's going on. But they made it work. And part of it was what we talked about in the pre-show bit, is that that movie is very New York. Like, it couldn't have been set anywhere else. It's so completely New York.
Yeah, and they're celebrity. It's not that they're just exterminators. These are celebrities.
Right.
These are people you want, you know, no job is too big, no fee is too big.
Yes, Mom, those guys from TV.
But to look at that montage, to see them running around famous, you know, noticeable places in New York City, to hear, you know, I mean, Casey Kasem and Larry King, like we mentioned, who were guys, you know, back then based in New York, you know, I mean, it just everything about that just kind of gave them that New York cred.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of added to that whole, you know, that whole vibe, I think.
Right. And then you have somebody like Sigourney Weaver, who up until this point only did serious dramas for the most part.
Sure.
Giving it sort of that other, like, oh, this is a legit film.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, she got top billing above Ramis and Moranis.
Did she really?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, Sigourney Weaver.
Huh. Well, she deserves billing over Rick Moranis, but, you know, fucking the mayor deserves billing over Rick Moranis.
I deserve billing over Rick Moranis.
Dude, Rick Moranis is hilarious in that movie.
He's good in that movie. I just don't like Rick Moranis.
I wanted to play Parcheesi for years.
I've been wanting to try their brie at room temperature for
the night of my life.
Okay, who brought the dog?
Okay, and, so
that's a funny scene. That's almost all improv too. Mm-hmm. He's going through the party talking to all his clients.
Yeah, that feels improv, and in a good way.
So funny.
Yeah, it is.
And I don't know, you know, it's when you watch films nowadays and you can tell there's improvisation, it just feels sloppy.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. And
hey, look, there's Michael Cera being the same character and he's improv.
Well, but I don't know. Then again, I'm a big fan of like the Christopher Guest movies, and quite a lot of that is improvised. And you know,
right, but that's not in a. They take the mockumentary feeling so that you're allowed to be a little bit more rambly.
True, but my point is, I think you get these comedians who came up in these, you know, workshop style performance things, you know, SCTV guys, and you know they're more. It's the same kind of thing. They're more theater trained. They're more, you know. They can do that a little better, I think. And I'll give Moranis credit there.
Yeah, you know, like people like Eugene Levy, who's a, you know, guest guy. And
right.
He gets the shit because he's in, like, the American Pie movies and other crap. But he's a fantastic improviser.
He is.
And he's very funny when he's allowed just to improvise.
Sure.
Not given, like, here's the lines you're going to say now.
Right. But, no, I mean, definitely Moranis is in his, I would say, his narrow sort of comfort zone there. Like, I don't like him playing... basically anybody but Louis Tully.
Okay, I can understand that. Well, yeah. I mean, what about Honey, I Shrunk the Kids?
Never saw those, actually. So.
And that came out in 1989, which brings me
back. This is a thing we were discussing briefly in the pre-show, just that summer when Ghostbusters 2 came out, and that's as good a segue as we're going to get. We might as well just jump to Ghostbusters 2, or as I call it, the disappointing.
Ghostbusters 2?
Two, yeah.
Die Hard Museum.
I watched this over the weekend to have it fresh in my head for recording. I haven't seen it in years, and I remember it as being pretty good but disappointing. It's a lot more disappointing than I remember, I'm sad to say.
So, you know, and this is when you brought up the fact that I kind of have a blind spot for the Ghostbusters, because I fucking love Ghostbusters 2. I mean, it's not as good as Ghostbusters 1, not as good as the animated series. Better than Slimer in the real Ghostbusters.
Right.
But I fucking loved it.
I think you see guys with proton packs and you think good movie, just like I see guys with lightsabers and think good movie. And all the sensible part of your brain just goes away. But now, Adrian, let's hear your take on this. You're kind of the third party here.
I told you guys, and I've said it on Twitter, I gave up Batman, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, and what was the other movie that
weekend?
Not UHF. It was another big movie, though.
That was a big fucking summer. I mean, if it was, you know.
I went to see Ghostbusters 2 without hesitation. I loved it.
Loved it as a kid, sure, but does it stand up now?
It doesn't.
Okay.
And the problem is, like I was going to say to you earlier, but I said, you were mentioning that Winston is essentially the outsider, and that's why you.
Right, in that first script, he's the guy who comes in the third act, so the audience can understand what's going on.
You know, Ray is the heart.
Venkman's the mouth. Right.
In the second one, they're all just, we are Ghostbusters. There's
right.
You could switch out Venkman with any other character dating Dana Baird, even, and it wouldn't make a lick of difference.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It just does not make a lick of difference.
That's a good point. Comedically, I think maybe not, because, I mean, they still occasionally gave Venkman, you know, the more Bill Murray-ish type lines, and, you know, Egon definitely gets the more, you know, Egon-ish type lines. But overall, I think you're right.
They certainly softened Venkman in Ghostbusters 2.
Yeah. There was a bit of that.
This came after the cartoon, so that was part of it.
Yeah, well, yeah. There were certainly no ghost blowjob scenes in Ghostbusters 2. I'll say that right now.
Yeah, it was a lot more family-friendly.
There was a baby.
Well, and that's the thing. First of all, like, I what really bothered me...
They did have some line, like, I want to run some gynecological tests on the mother.
Yeah, that's true.
it's less than the sum of its parts, which is hard to do.
Now, there's a lot of great one-liners, but overall, the story just isn't there for me.
You're right. And, the idea of New York being... like, even the mayor makes fun of it. I should tell New Yorkers just to be happy. Like, and that's what I say. It's like, that's stupid. You know, that's the pinnacle of just sort of idiocy, that we should all just get along and be happy.
Right. Well, and for me, it was a lot of the contrivance. It was a lot of like, oh, well, Dana's coincidentally in another, you know, thing. Like, that's what really bothered me. And it bothers me in most sequels is when they try to bring characters back together and they force it. And it's like, well, Dana's baby's in trouble now. Or really? She's involved in another apocalypse? Her?
Dana's baby who has some father that we never really discuss.
Right.
He was the guy at the fountain.
Right.
The stiff?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know, you know. And you're right about forcing, because like the forced relationship of Janine and Lewis really hurts.
That really pissed me off.
Oh, and I could hear across space and time, I could hear young Matt's heart breaking.
Harold Ramis didn't want to have them hook up.
All right.
And I so, just I,
thanks
no,
a lot,
I,
Harold Ramis.
Well, they both wear glasses.
Mm-hmm. Well, not only that, I really just don't. I like the idea that Lewis thinks he could actually have a relationship with Dana Barrett. I think that's funny.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But I also like in the cartoon, and that happened in between. And I guess if we're going chronologically, we should have done that. But whatever. I like that she sort of carried a torch for Egon. Like she always sort of just.
Janine.
Yeah.
Janine.
Right.
Yeah. Not
that, that was cut out of the first film.
What's that?
Her feelings for Egon. Like we have a little bit, but
well,
there's a lot more.
There's some flirtation there, but through the animated series, she's still kind of trying to get him.
In the deleted scenes, there's a lot more.
Really?
She gives him a medal.
Wow.
Her father or something.
Oh yeah, yeah, I remember that.
Oh nice. I didn't know about that.
There was a bunch of stuff, and Ramis decided to cut it out because he didn't think Egon would even understand what was happening.
Well, there's enough left in there where it's very clear that he's rebuffing her, but not he doesn't really consider her feelings. It's like, no, leave me alone. I'm busy.
Well, and at the end, she's like, she runs up to him and gives him a hug during the credit sequence.
Right.
And
yep.
All of a sudden, now she's making
it. There was enough there that I bought that she kind of had this crush on him. And then in the second movie, he's like, no, let's hook up the two nerdy characters. Oh, really?
And, like, there's so many good ideas. Like, the slime pack, that's a great idea.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. But dancing Statue of Liberty, not so much.
Oh, come on, dude. Embrace Your Love is Lifting Me Higher.
Yeah.
Your love
lifted
me higher than I've ever
lifted before.
All right. Well, that happened. And
no,
that...
The original the working title of Ghostbusters 2 was Ghostbusters 2 River of Slime.
Yep.
Can't imagine why they didn't go with that. Yeah, I mean, there's just so much absurdity in there. Like I say, the dancing Statue of Liberty and just the prancing, mincing foreign painting guy.
Oh, Tommy, why so?
Yeah. Here's Wego, you're tearing me apart.
Oh, Dana, I was thinking maybe you do very nice.
And, you know, it's one thing if you cast an actual foreign guy to play that, but it was just a normal American actor doing a stupid accent. And come on, Ghostbusters, you're supposed to be better than that. You're better than Robin Williams, for Christ's sake.
And then you have Max von Sydow. This guy's in fucking Wild Strawberries and Seventh Seal, and he's Viggo the Park Carpathian.
He is Viggo.
Was that Max von Sydow? I didn't know that.
Yeah, he was Max von Sydow.
That's fantastic.
And he reprised his role in the video game.
Yep.
Nice. Well,
one-liners.
So Matt, let's hear. I mean, honestly, without just saying, but I just love it. Really, what's your defense? And I don't mean like argue with me, but like why? Tell us some of the good stuff. Like, let's hear the positive.
I don't have one. I think it's right. Funny. I think it's awesome seeing the actual guys playing the Ghostbusters back again.
All right.
One of the most depressing openings of any movie ever.
See, now that I enjoyed. I loved that the last movie ended with them as heroes, and then we come back and it's like, no, nobody believed them, and they're broke, and they're not allowed to bus ghosts anymore. That I liked.
Yep.
I'll tell you what I liked is the Run DMC, the Ghostbusters theme.
Well,
I don't know. I think it's really good, actually.
Yeah, I'm a Run DMC mark. Like anything they do, I'm there for. So,
and I think it's silly and fun, and I enjoy that. So,
way better than the Bobby Brown song that they ended up using in the titles, actually.
Yeah, that's sad.
And am I mistaken, or do you guys know? Did I catch a Bobby Brown cameo?
He's the one who asked if he can get his unpack for Christmas.
And it's like, wow, yep, it sure is 1989 here. Man, is it ever 1989?
Yeah, it just, I don't know. Like, there's just so many parts that you want it to be great, and it just consistently just doesn't.
There were a couple, like I said, there were some good lines. There's one that actually struck me. There's that great sort of one-liner where they charge up their proton packs for the first time. And, you know, do, re, Egon. And I remember that being Egon being out of touch and stupid and just not getting the joke. But watching it again, he does this little smirk.
Oh, yeah, he gets the joke.
Yeah, no, yeah. I'm stepping on their punchline because I'm a dick. And that made it a lot funnier to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's cute to see Louis Tully being a Ghostbuster, but at the same time, it's like, when does this guy have any aspirations to be a Ghostbuster?
No, that just, that to me, that felt like sort of tacked on fan service. Like,
what fans?
What do you mean, what fan? No, just
the Legion of Louis Tully fans.
Louis Tully in a Ghostbuster outfit.
No.
Do you think was around at that point?
Every fan in the audience who wanted to put on a suit and be a Ghostbuster. No, I'm not saying Louis Tully fans. I'm saying. He's the audience stand-in, the guy, you know, hey, there's an extra suit and an extra pack. Let me join, guys.
Okay, see, that was another thing. He puts that thing, and I'm just like, bullshit, you're not a Ghostbuster.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is the guys writing it probably were thinking all the 8-year-olds in the audience who want to be a Ghostbuster themselves are going to shit themselves when they see this, because the loser guy even gets to be one. Anybody can be a Ghostbuster.
And
yay!
I did. When right. I was that age.
Well, that's who it was written for, I think.
I'm like, he's not. Let me screening process like Winston had to go.
Now let's,
you believe in the Loch Ness monster,
right? Now let's. I mean, we mentioned Winston kind of not really having a particular role in that movie. What is his job sort of supposed to be in the team?
Is their accountant?
No, Winston.
If you believe the animated series, then he was the one who was supposed to drive the car.
No, actually, you mentioned that, but when I watched the animated series, it was usually Ray driving.
In the producer's Bible, it says Winston is the only one allowed to drive the car, so that must be
yeah.
Well, I watched in...
That was probably a JMS episode.
No, I watched a bunch of them.
Them off.
I watched a bunch of them in season 2, and it was always Venkman and Winston in the back seat, and Ray driving and Egon in the passenger seat.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. And they recycled a lot of animation on that show, so once they set it up once, they just used it every time.
That's probably what it was.
Yeah. He had a distinct role. It's harder to sort of place than, you know.
Well, the show,
the other guys.
The show went into more depth as far as the team goes, and you know, like any long running show, you get episodes that focus on specific characters and all that. Mm. But overall, he didn't feel nearly as out of place on the show. He just felt another guy on the team.
But, well, here's the thing: Winston belongs just because he has my favorite line of Ghostbusters too.
Oh yeah.
When they're in the tunnel, going to the River of Slime again, and walking, they're like, hey! Yo! Yo! Hello! Winston! It's the best.
Yeah, that's quite good.
It's actually made its way into my life.
Well, but I mean, even that, I mean, this is definitely one of those movies, and typically when we do like a you know, one of these theme shows, it's one of those things that we talk about so much that it's part of our vocabulary. The first movie has so many lines like that. The second one has 2 or 3.
Yeah.
To me, that's the definitive, like, you know, 25 years later, Christ, 26 years later, we're still saying, you know, yes, have some, and you know, all that. But
what did you do, Ray?
But what are you quoting from Ghostbusters 2, apart from Adrian, who, like all of us, likes to pick out obscure shit to say just because it's funny?
I can't think of a single line of
it. Yeah.
Like, but in the first one, like, there's so many lines, even like, there is no Dana, only Zool.
Oh, yeah.
I see it all the time. Like, like, it's sad, the amount that... And I just assume everybody knows what I'm talking about.
And if you got another friend in the room with you, they can just turn and say, you know, what a lovely singing voice you must have. I mean, it's an easy movie to quote back, you know?
Oh, Zuli, you nut.
Right. And it's one of those movies, really, you can get carried away with, because there's not a lot of slow down. There's not a lot of like a, well, now, you know, no more jokes. Got to stop quoting now. You could just do a whole scene for like half an hour. I mean, it's that kind of movie.
Let's bring up something really weird in Ghostbusters 2 as well, when a weird European guy dresses up as a nanny.
Yeah, that was...
A ghost nanny with with Mr. Fantastic Stretch Armstrong.
Yeah, that...
This is the power of Viggo's offering you, huh?
That felt to me like they staged a really awkward shot and they had to fix it in post, and like they couldn't get the ghost close enough, so like he stretches.
Well, to me that felt like a shot where it's like he's a ghost.
Yeah.
And he's a nanny?
And he can pick things up?
No, he just has ghost nanny powers. Different. So
he knows how to pull feet of ghosts, stuff like that.
Well, so now, so that movie happened, was it a financial success? I remember it being.
Did
it?
Let me see here.
It had the biggest, well, let's see here.
As we mentioned, the summer of 1989 was a fucking just blockbuster. Yeah. You know, I mean, the first Tim Burton Batman and Indie and the Last Crusade and Lethal Weapon 2 and just a shitload of blockbuster movies. So if it got lost in the shuffle, we couldn't, you know, we could even allow for that.
Biggest 3-day opening weekend gross in history, broken a week later by Batman.
But I mean, it made $215 million worldwide.
Right.
$20 million budget, I think.
Yeah, and in the summer of Batman, that's particularly, you know, noteworthy, because people who might not remember, that movie steamrolled over fucking everything.
Mm-hmm.
So that's quite an accomplishment in that summer. But what I'm getting at is it was enough of a success that they've been talking about Ghostbusters 3 ever since. And it's, I mean, you guys know as nerds reading, you know, well, websites now, but back in the day, like magazines, there's always been that rumor though, we're going to do this, we're going to have new guys. At one point, Chris Farley was going to be in it, and it was just this whole thing, and enough, make it or don't.
Now in Ghostbusters 3, they'll be looking for the ghost of Chris Farley.
Right. But I think this is definitely something we need to address, like the various fake out incarnations of Ghostbusters 3 over the years.
Yeah, that's a good point. Because, like, the original, I remember back in, oh, what was it, like 1996?
Yeah, it wasn't too far long after 2 that they were talking about 3.
They were like, Ghostbusters 3 is written and it's happening.
Yeah.
Mm.
And it was like, basically, hell is full and it's coming to Earth now. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, holy shit, that's awesome.
Yeah, and it was going to be Ghostbusters go to hell. Hell.
Yeah. And then that didn't happen.
Right, and that's when they were talking about Chris Farley, right? Because, I mean, he died not long after that, so would have had to have been around then.
The lineup for that film would have been amazing. The two I know were Will Smith and Chris Farley.
Oh, yeah. What I recall was they were going to be training sort of the next generation, sort of the next, you know, the next Ghostbusters, and it was a pretty good, like, solid lineup of younger comedians, which is a good idea.
And, you know, say what you will about Will Smith, he can be a funny guy when he wants to.
Oh, no, and that was him at his peak. Like, in the mid to late 90s, that was the Will Smith to get, you know?
And I'm assuming they'd probably get like Sandler or somebody. Say what you will, but that's at that point in time, that would have been the film.
Well, whoever were the biggest names coming out of SNL and other places like that, I mean, made sense. Whether I agree with the choices or not, that makes sense to me.
Right, and you know, and then of course it didn't happen, and you know, the rumors about Bankman being a ghost have been for years, and you know, they keep coming back over and over every time the thing comes, and yet Murray keeps flip-flopping his opinion. One week he doesn't want to do it, one week he does want
to. Well, now the idea of Venkman being a ghost, I've heard this, like you say, thrown around for years. I love that idea in the sense that
it's done in the IDW comics, their first miniseries.
Very cool.
The other side, they do just that, and it's
not nearly.
Well, because
that was the comic I was ranting about last year that I thought was a giant piece of shit.
Well, we'll get to the comics. But as far as that concept goes, what's up?
I'm just picking on that.
Okay, I'm all for that. No, I like the concept because really, ghostbusting, like, yeah, there's some threat, there's some stakes, but overall, we're kind of treated like it's this whimsical thing, and ghosts aren't actually people. They're just these monsters. And to actually take a person we know and we've developed a connection with and say, now here's a ghost, what do you do? Like, I like kind of turning the concept on its ear and saying, these aren't all monsters. It could be a guy you know. Like, that's kind of cool.
They're not all ancient Sumerian gods.
Right.
Well, in the initial script that Ackroyd wrote, it was a gap.
Uh-huh.
And then that was it. It wasn't like a plot point, which I think you have to make it a plot point.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm saying is an exploration of the idea that you're effectively shooting at and trapping dead people. You know, I just kind of delving into that is cool because you never really consider Slimer must have been a dude before he was a ghost, right?
Right, absolutely.
Well, technically, he was a guy who died in the hotel, I think.
Was he?
I'm sure I heard that somewhere.
I know the unofficial story is that he's the ghost of John Belushi.
In canon, he is a patron of the hotel who died in the hotel on the 13th.
Right. So, I mean, but we don't really think of it as a dude. We think of it as just this weird little animal monster thing. Mm. And like I say, just making them, forcing them to treat them more as human beings. And whoa, wait, this is Pete. We can't just zap him. What, you know, what do you do? Like, I think that could be cool in the right hands. But on the other hand, you know. But I've heard so many weird ideas for Ghostbusters 3 over time, and it's come and gone and come and gone, and they're talking about it now. And what was it?
It is, as far as I know, it's happening.
Yeah, okay, that's what we thought in 1996.
It's happening. It is going to be filming probably sooner, if not.
Like, it's this summer, I think.
You're going to have to forgive my skepticism here. There are a few geek sequels. Matt, go ahead. Say it.
With what?
No. Come on, geek sequels.
Yes.
Do I got to spoon feed you this one, really? Geekquels. God damn it. Left it right there for you. That we were teased with for years. There was Indiana Jones 4, there's Ghostbusters 3, and there's like one or two other movies. And I refuse to believe until I actually see a preview. Like until there's a trailer.
Well, here's my fear. I've got two major fears. One is the script is written by the guys who... They wrote two of the guys who write up for The Office and Curb Your Enthusiasm. While both those shows are funny, both the episodes that they wrote are funny. They also wrote Year One, which was
funny. Yeah, but on the other hand, real quick, you know, I love and adore the new Star Trek movie, and I hate with a passion Transformers 2, and they were written by the same people. So
yeah,
that's not always a good indication of quality.
My other fear is that Ivan Reitman is, you know, and Matt's excited because Ivan Reitman is directing it, or at least put onto it. I remember that was the opinion that I received when I asked about it. But I am nervous because, like I said, Evolution really...
Well, now what else has Reitman done in the last few... I mean, Evolution was
not
Christ.
Much. Not much.
Yeah.
Talk about something else while I look it up.
I mean, the concept of Ghostbusters 3, it just worries me. Just because, like...
Is it still the same hell is full, or are they going with something else now?
That I don't know. I'm pretty sure it's supposed to be like that. I'm pretty sure it's still supposed to be Ghostbusters in hell.
Mm-hmm.
Do you really want to know what he's directed recently?
No, I'm just interested in what was his last hit. Like, what was his last decent movie?
It?
Well, not even financial hit, but, like, a cult hit would be...
I would say the last decent movie that he did.
Okay, I like Dave, okay. But that was 1994?
93. Then he did Junior.
Yeah, not so much.
Days, Seven Nights, Evolution, and My Super Ex-Girlfriend.
Oh, really?
Yeah, maybe not so much there.
Now you understand why I'm kind of concerned.
Okay, now I'm worried.
He was working on a remake of The Pink Panther, but backed out.
Well, that was a wise move, looking at what Steve Martin's turned that into. But
he did produce I Love You, Man, which was a pretty solid comedy.
Okay.
I didn't see it, but I heard good things.
It's solid. It's not the best thing ever, but it's solid.
Okay, but I mean, you know, when we're judging comedies, you got to step back and say, okay, we're not looking at you know, like great cinema here. We're looking at did it make you laugh? And if he's,
I wish his kid was directing. I wish Jason, you know, the guy who's doing Up in the Air,
right? And Thank You for Smoking as well. Yeah,
I wish he directed because that would be awesome.
Yeah, he's turned out pretty okay.
I'm assuming he won't because.
Well, that, and you really don't want to, like, you know, it's kind of like back in the day when they were talking about doing a Beatles reunion and getting Julian to step in for his dad. Come on, no.
Well, I mean, and it's hard because what do you do with how do you do it, you know, a spinoff of this? Like, you know what I'm saying? Who do you cast as these new Ghostbusters?
Well, if that's the concept they're still going with, if it's the old guys are hanging around training new recruits.
And I mean, if they were doing it that way, then obviously they'd be hoping to kickstart the franchise again.
Sure. I don't know, because I'm not as, I mean, I'll admit it, I'm kind of out of touch as far as who the young hotness is with comedy these days. I have no clue.
Well, like Michael Cera, he's expressed that he wants to be in Ghostbusters, and that would be his dream.
Yeah, he's not allowed to do anything until they make a fucking Arrested Development movie, but that's another issue for another time.
Well, but at the same time, it's like, why don't you stop playing the same character?
Right. Yeah, show us you got some range, and we'll talk.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But, like, you know, there's, you know, Jack Black obviously is...
I'd like to see Simon Pegg in there.
I'm sure Simon Pegg would like to see himself in there. Like, that's not a hard sell.
But it's like, I enjoy the, and I think the idea of Murray as a ghost and like Ray, you know, Aykroyd as a teacher, Aykroyd and Harry, Ramis as teachers is fun.
Sure.
You know, I think bringing back, you know, even using maybe Ernie Hudson, who they wouldn't have to pay as much, obviously. Well, and, you know,
well,
they could use
why would they start a, now?
Yeah.
Well, they could use him as a, you know, like hands-on tutor. He could be in more of the film.
Sure.
He obviously is very, does, I think he does well as a character.
And oh, no, no, he's a decent actor. They just kind of gave him the shaft as far as the part goes.
Yeah.
I don't think it was ever a question of could he carry more if they gave him more. But yeah, making him the veteran, making him the one that you haven't seen what I've seen, kid, and Gozer was some hard shit, and that kind of, you know, that could be pretty cool. So yeah, I don't know, guys. Like I said, I've heard for years that this movie's going to happen. I won't believe it until I see like at least a teaser trailer.
Yeah.
It's one of those things. I was the same with Indiana Jones. It's just they got it almost off the ground so many times. It's like, nah, I'm not getting my hopes up.
I agree.
Now, let's say, for the sake of argument, they, you know, this thing definitely surfaces, and it doesn't look great. Like, they got a kind of a hacky director, and they didn't get, you know, you'd be there anyway, wouldn't you?
Dude, I'll go see anything with Proton Pack.
That's what I figure. Adrian?
Absolutely. And I think I just found my old lineup here.
Okay.
No, I found somebody else's lineup that I really enjoyed.
Mm.
This is off of the place we're not allowed to name. Neil Patrick Harris, Mos Def, Simon Pegg, Seth Rogen.
Take Mos Def out of there and maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. I thought he was cute when he was doing the fake Ghostbusters thing in Be Kind.
Oh, yeah.
In which?
Be Kind Rewind.
Ah, I didn't care for that movie. I watched it for a few minutes.
It has a really great Ghostbusters sequence.
Yeah.
It takes all the good parts and just shows it why it's such a great movie.
That's cool. Well, I mean, that's not a bad lineup. Like I said, Mos Def for me was not great as Ford Prefect in the Hitchhikers movie, and so I kind of have a grudge against him. But
I like him as an actor. He just wasn't a great pick for Ford.
Right.
Well, the Hitchhikers movie wasn't very good for what the Hitchhikers movie.
Well, no, that's true, too.
Yeah, that's another subject for another time, too. So, yeah, regardless, I think it's safe to say our love for this thing goes beyond any kind of, you know, even if we have solid indications that it's crap, we'll all be there.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully they don't fuck it up.
Let's talk about the cartoon.
Yes, absolutely.
Fuck yeah.
Now we get into one of the more enduring elements. And this is interesting because I never really watched this show that much. I caught bits and pieces of it, but I did some research for this show and I sat down and watched some DVDs and like, fuck, this is good. It's not like I wasn't nostalgic. It wasn't one of those, I loved this as a kid. And so, therefore, I want to watch it now. No.
Wait, we're talking about the Filmation one, right?
Motherfucker.
Nice.
They had an ape.
That gorilla was just the best. Now, the real Ghostbusters was just so sharply written and so, like, I would say it predated a lot of the more adult-friendly kids shows of the early 90s by, like, 5 years.
Oh, yeah.
Like before The Simpsons brought in that wave of things like Animaniacs and stuff like that where kids and adults could both appreciate it. There wasn't a lot like that on TV. This was a toy commercial and that was it. And it was still solid.
Just amazingly well written.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I was watching them, you know, this last week as well. And I was literally clicks away from putting down the $100 to get that box set that came out from Timeline.
Oh, that was a tough one not to buy for me.
They have this gorgeous box set that's $100 at the entire show. And watching these, it's just like, this is a real, I was enjoying myself. Like,
yeah. And we're enjoying ourselves as adults. Like there's some nostalgia factor for you guys probably.
It's not nostalgia. I was like, this is just well written.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It is now production wise, I had some problems with like the way it's animated and there's like some awkward pauses and you can tell there's a good script and every now and then the production just kind of screws it up a little, but the writing shines through so much that it doesn't matter. Overall, it's just fucking solid.
Well, the original voice cast was also pretty spot on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was saying this to you, Matt, earlier. It's interesting that those cartoon versions of the characters don't really look or sound like the guys in the movies, but to me, they look and sound exactly like the characters.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I don't know how they did it, but like, for instance, you know, Lorenzo Music sounds nothing like Bill Murray, and the cartoon character looks nothing like Bill Murray, but that's Venkman.
That's Venkman.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know a lot of people give Lorenzo Music shit because of the Garfield thing, and obviously this is what led around to Murray being Garfield in the film.
Yeah, that was just fucking weird.
But, like, I absolutely love Lorenzo Musico as Peter Venkman.
No, he's fantastic.
Oh, yeah, he was perfect.
That ensemble there, those four guys were great together.
Best voice actings I've ever heard.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And that guy doesn't have range, but he doesn't need range. I mean, he just played that character.
No, he his timing was perfect. He was funny.
Yeah. I mean, all of them, really. I was surprised. I didn't realize until watching this recently that Egon was Maurice LaMarche. It's like, hey, I know that guy. I didn't realize he had popped up sort of on the animation scene until later than that. So that was a nice surprise.
There was I was reading how when he went to read for Egon, they specifically told him not to do it as Harold Ramis, but mm-hmm. he did it anyway, and that's why he got the job.
Nice. But I think he sounds – and it's funny that, like, what they gave Egon blonde hair – and they do all these things, just really weird, but it totally works.
Yeah, like I'm saying, for some reason, they don't look anything like their movie counterparts, but they look exactly like the characters to me. I don't know what that's about.
There is one thing where Venkman looks more like Bill Murray. And that's
I showed that to Al. Yes.
We'll put that in the show notes. It's one of the early trailers.
They're pilot.
Oh, my God. The unaired pilot has to be the most exciting 3.5 minutes of a cartoon I've ever seen. It's just you're the Ghostbusters, and they're just going fucking crazy on your ass for 3.5 minutes.
Nice.
And it's like the car is going everywhere. Stuff's exploding. Like, it's nonstop action. And it's, you know, it's obviously just a pitch trailer.
Sure.
But it's awesome. And I told my brother about it because he was also a Ghostbusters fan. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was just like, oh, my God, this is the coolest thing ever. And now he wants to watch Ghostbusters cartoons.
Well, the thing about the show is Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry to go back really quick.
No, that's okay.
To go back to Ghostbusters 2, there was one other thing that was good, and that was they released jumpsuits. Ghostbusters jumpsuits for kids because I had one.
Okay, well, the merch was good, but that's...
And when I was a kid, I hated you.
If I was still my body of an 8-year-old, I would be wearing it right now.
We don't need to hear what you're going to do with the body of an 8-year-old, please.
I'll just leave that for Ben and Albert next time.
All right. So, as far as this cartoon goes, it was great because it was an extension of the movies, but at the same time, it opened up this whole field of they could deal a lot more with the paranormal directly. There was a lot more demons and mythology. There was a fucking Cthulhu episode.
Much to my delight.
Awesome.
Yeah, it was. Awesome. Like, I only have kind of a base, you know, familiarity with Lovecraft, but I watched it with Amanda, who knows that shit backwards and forwards, and she's like, they got everything right. There's Miskatonic University, there's Arkham, there's, like, all this stuff. They got a couple of tiny minor details they probably changed, like, on purpose.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's funny that they reference Gozer and how Gozer's nothing compared to, like, so it gives, kids who've seen the movie, like, kids who've obviously seen the movie, it gives them a frame of reference.
Oh, there were all kinds of callbacks in the show, too, which was great. Like, a lot of the dialogue was informed by the movie, but it also wasn't them copying lines from the movie. It was so smartly written. And I don't even think we've...
Yeah, it's like the movie actually, like, it felt like it was a part of the history of the show. Like,
yeah.
A lot of those shows that were based on movies or, like, adult movies would just never talk about it.
Yeah.
I remember that distinctly from the RoboCop cartoon.
Well, and I think sometimes, like that they couldn't. Or sometimes
they
just
talk about the guy blowing up after getting melted from acid.
No, for some reason they didn't mention that.
But sometimes there's legal stuff involved. Sometimes they have to, you know, make things distinct for certain reasons or whatever. But, like, there's that weird law that it's cheaper, like copyright law, where it's cheaper to buy the rights to a song and record it yourself than it is just to use the song, which is why there's an almost pitch perfect duplication of the Ray Parker Jr. theme on that show.
Yeah, the guy's really good. And what kills me about this show is that for years, they're finally starting to release it on DVD.
Yeah.
For years, it was almost impossible to get on VHS. And yet this cartoon in the 80s was the number one Saturday morning cartoon.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I was reading the ratings, and it was across the board the most popular cartoon, the most popular toy brand. Like, across the board.
Well, and my little brother is you guys' age, and he had all the toys. I mean, I can definitely, you know.
As did I.
The greatest day of my life was getting the Firehouse for Christmas.
Nice. Oh,
best Christmas ever. I got the Ecto-1.
Ooh.
Oh, my God.
Fantastic.
It had a trap that would reel up out of the back seat. And
I remember that. That was fantastic.
The chair on the roof spun around. And,
gun on it, and you're just like,
but it is
travel back in time and kill the garage sale that got sold at.
oh man, that sucks. My mom, who never collects anything, made a valiant effort to make sure we have all the Ghostbusters toys still.
Oh, that's
my.
Obviously, none of the packaging. They're all and they're all broken because we shit out of those.
Well, toys. You played with them. They're toys.
When I turned 10, my grandfather decided that it was time for me to become a man and sold all my childhood toys.
How did that work out for you, man?
Are you feeling mannish now?
Yeah.
Well.
No, that's just the rosebud effect now. Now he's just trying to get it all back.
Ecto one.
Oh, so hold on. So when Matt dies and he whispers, Winston.
Right. You know what they come interview me first. I got it covered. It's cool. But
it was the guys, it was his sled.
Right, got it. Why didn't you just buy another sled? So as far as the cartoon series goes, I don't even think we've mentioned this name yet. J. Michael Straczynski, who's famous for creating Babylon 5, famous for comic book work out the ass. Just
half a great run on Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Great run on almost every comic.
he was the brain behind this. He was the showrunner for the first little while there, and he wrote a lot of the episodes that we really loved.
Well, there's one episode that everybody brings up, and it was one of the syndication episodes called Ragnarok and Roll.
Yeah, I saw that one.
Which at the end, this a character has basically a sort of soliloquy about how love can leave you at any time, and that you need to make your own, you know, what you love in your life matter. And it was just it has merit to me now.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with nostalgia. It has nothing to do with like these pathetic things where people are like, "I watched that episode of Transformers."
Hey, shut up, man.
No, you know what I mean.
Though. Yeah, I do.
Put overemphasis on things that have no meaning.
Yeah,
like that had meaning, and it was strangely resonant. Mm-hmm.
It was, and what I like was, I mean, they're dealing with some pretty hardcore stuff. They're dealing with a lot of occult stuff, which in the 80s, well, now anytime really, trying to get that stuff to kids is not easy. You got parents groups and whatever, just, you know, no, Harry Potter is satanic and crap like that.
Not only that, just in the decade where Ewoks, like, and droids, Ewoks couldn't have fire unless it was created by magic.
Wow.
I remember reading an interview with Straczynski when they were working on the Cthulhu episode, mm-hmm. and someone came up to him and said, "Well, you've got the Necronomicon in here." And he goes, "Uh-huh." And the guy goes, "Well, you can't use that. That's a real occult book." And Straczynski goes, "No, it was created by H.P. Lovecraft back in like 1930, whatever."
Right.
And it's like, no, I was told that it's a legitimate occult.
Yeah, and I know this guy who knows these kids who killed themselves playing D&D, so it must be real.
Exactly. That is exactly what happened.
Yeah. No, but really, looking at there's an episode where this is my favorite one that I watched. I watched like 10 or 15 of these, two DVDs worth. The one that I love, and I can't imagine one being better than this, but maybe it will be. Dude sells his soul to a demon to rid the world of chickens.
Yeah.
So fucking great.
Isn't that the cluck?
The chicken he clucked, it was called.
Yeah. And okay. It's just comedically, it's great, but there's also some kind of dark stuff going on. And the gist of it is the demon who does it goes back to hell. And of course, they can't say demon. They can't say soul. They can't say hell, but you know what's going on. Mm. All the demon shows up and he says, you know the price, right? And that's all they can say. They can't say he's selling his soul, but you know. But he goes back and all the demons, he's like the laughing stock of the underworld because, hey, you gonna rid the world of pigeons next? Ah, you know, it's just fucking fantastic.
There was, it looks like J.M. DeMatteis actually wrote an episode, which I didn't know.
Really?
He's actually been involved with a lot of TV over the years, and it always surprises me every time, and it shouldn't anymore.
But Catherine Drennan, who wrote a couple episodes of Babylon 5 and stuff like that, she wrote an episode that I liked called Night Game, where Winston wanted to go to a baseball game and nobody would follow him. And it turned out that site, every 5 years, good and evil fought it out.
Oh, nice.
And they fought it out over the life of one soul. And basically, Winston chose what the form of battle was, and he decided it was a baseball game.
That's pretty cool.
Great episode.
Yeah.
And the big twist is that they think, the Ghostbusters think they're fighting for Winston's soul, and they're afraid that he's going to die and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Like, stuff happens, and there's a little bit of morality about cheating and stuff like that.
Sure.
Ultimately, it turns out they're fighting over Venkman's soul. And, he's like, holy shit.
That's
and
nice.
You know, even I was laughing about it. You know, this is again, nothing to do with nostalgia, just because it's fine writing.
Right. Mm-hmm. No, and there's a bit in one of the other episodes where they end up in hell. And it might have been the one I was talking about, actually. I can't remember. It doesn't matter. But they're all standing there. They realize where they are. And, of course, they can't say hell on a kid's show. But they look around at the jagged rocks and the fire and the ragged clothes and the heat. My God, the heat. And and Venkman says, wow, people always tell me I should go here, and here I am. And for a kid's show, that's like, whoa, nice.
There was a couple episodes of the first season that I really thought were awesome, and that's one of them is the Christmas episode, which I think is one of the best Christmas episodes ever made. Yeah, I don't remember
that one.
Basically, they go through a time warp, and they go to a Christmas Carol world. And
oh, yeah.
The three spirits are visiting Scrooge.
Oh, nice.
And they bust them because they think, oh, they're ghosts. This is our job.
That's fantastic.
Well, they find, and they go back to the future. Oh, and yeah. The World Hates Christmas. There's like a bestseller by Ebenezer Scrooge.
Oh, that's awesome.
Why I Hate Christmas and stuff like that. So basically, this is the first episode they go into the containment unit because they have to rescue the ghosts from the containment. Mm-hmm. Which sort of sets up that like the containment unit is its own universe.
Right. Yeah, which I love that idea. I love that.
Awesome. And like, you know, Egon has to go in there and rescue these ghosts, and it's really like when I was a kid, I was scared to death every time. I was like, oh no. Is he going to make this time? And meanwhile, Peter, Winston, and Ray are having to pretend that they are the spirits of present, past. like Peter is the ghost of Christmas past, and he's running around with Scrooge in a wheelchair and with a Viewmaster for his past. It's a great episode. It's one, and that's a JMS episode. And then the other one is Citizen Ghost, which is actually on the. They released that 2-pack DVD with
Ghost. Yeah.
So that was actually on there. And that's like sort of a pilot episode where they combine, where they explain why Slimer's with them and why they have, like, why they
trust. Yeah, why is Slimer with them? Because it seems like stupid comic relief, and it seems like, you know, he's a ghost. Why don't you bust him?
He was actually evil, but then, like, he almost got killed by some Ghostbuster, like, ghosts of Ghostbusters.
Mm-hmm.
Because their suits were contaminated with Gozers.
With Gozer, yeah.
Yeah, and they became evil. And they almost killed Slimer, and he apologized and went for his ways. And Ray vouched for him. And it's like, it brings a little bit of continuity where it's not necessary, but it's fun.
Well, that's cool.
It's one of the better episodes, and it's real early on.
So. Yeah.
Cool.
JMS episodes, and they're all, like, really, really fantastic. Like, there's another one where it's a Halloween episode that explains, like, Halloween wasn't all just a pagan culture, like, literally. It was the day when ghosts took over the world.
Nice.
The force of evil had to retake it back, or else they would keep it.
Yeah, the whole mythology of that show was fantastic. Guys, unfortunately, we're starting to hit our time here. We have a couple of questions we're going to have to get to. Okay. And anything else we need to address? I mean, we could do this for hours and hours.
So in the Filmation one, you had the ape, and then you had the talking car.
Let's step back first. Filmation technically created Ghostbusters first. The name Ghostbusters, the concept of Ghostbusters, in a horrible live-action show from the 70s.
Yeah.
Which my buddy had a tape of that he let me borrow, and I watched an episode, and it was atrocious.
I've seen – there's only clips on YouTube, and I've seen them, and yeah.
Yeah.
The cartoon was a continuation of that same storyline that everybody remembers.
The cartoon was very Filmation. Like, it was very – there was about 10 minutes of animation padding out 25 minutes, and just painful.
And there was a lesson of the day at the very end of it.
Yeah, there sure was.
Yeah.
And their main villain, Prime Evil, was a robot ghost, which, Adrian, I know you're a fan of robot ghosts. So
I know I am. And real quick, one last thing. The comics, other than the IDW ones, there was – 88 Miles Per Hour let me down. Studios let me down big time.
Oh, shit. Yeah, they did.
Monsters Legion comic was awesome. But it's a great comic that really showed potential where they went, and then nothing happened with it. So
mm-hmm. My only problem with that thing was that they insisted on setting it, like, now. So, like, 2004, whenever the hell it came out.
2004, and they assumed that Ghostbusters 2 never happened.
Yeah,
oh,
exactly.
Well, I could live in that world, but but everyone else being 20 years older, not so much.
Like, Louis Tully was a celebrity because everybody loved him.
It assumed that Ghostbusters had taken place in, like, 2002 or something.
Oh.
And that movie is just so quintessentially 80s to me.
It really is.
And then one last thing. The game, even though the new game has some problems, it's great to see them again and the voices in a new script. I like
Mm-hmm. And the only thing better than the new game is the classic game for the Commodore 64.
Yeah, and I really wished we would have more time to discuss that, because that game, I wasn't even a Ghostbusters fan. Like I said, I was kind of late to the party, but that was probably my favorite C64 game back in the day, just on its own merits alone.
I just played that shit over and over and over again.
Yeah, and there is an emulated version of that on the web that we will post a link to. All right, we got some questions here. Like I say, I hate to rush through this, but we still had stuff. I mean, Adrian dug up old copies of the pen and paper RPG that I really wish we had more time to discuss.
This episode is going to have the most
show notes ever.
Show notes ever.
Well, I don't know.
So I got an idea, guys. Actually, go to algar.com, look up the fucking show notes, and leave some fucking comments, all right?
Sure, there you go. Thanks for that.
Thank you, Adrian.
But no, I did want to briefly mention that did exist, and it sounds suitably absurd. And
Or how about the out-of-print book where Peter Venkman runs for mayor?
Oh, yeah. I've been looking for that thing forever. I got a job at a used bookstore to find that thing.
That's why you work there, huh?
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Fantastic. All right, real quick, guys, we got some questions here. And most of them are kind of quick, jokey questions. Adrian went trolling on Facebook. Thank you for that. But, you know, when your friends see you're doing that, they tend to just throw stuff out there. So,
not a problem.
In the Ghostbusters CD-ROM, is it possible to get out of the dungeon without using the Sorcerer's Key?
You guys are not allowed to say it, so I will. What the hell are you talking about?
Oh, we're allowed. You need to catch up on your podcast. There is no more verboten.
Oh shit!
We
can.
What
the hell are you talking about? You need to use the Contra code.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question, Ethan Ehler, is that right?
Ehler.
Yeah. Why would a grown man care about a kid's cartoon? Is that the quote?
Why would a man whose shirt says genius at work
right, there we
spend
go.
All this time watching a children's cartoon?
There you go. Thank you. Sorry about that.
I resent his question.
Can we expect to see Ghostbusters Origins Stay Puffed Marshmallow Man become a reality? That comes from Dirk Walker.
I'm working on it.
The origin was Ray remembered it from camp and he thought of it. That's where he started. The end.
When his eggs popped on Dana's counter.
What's that? Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Bag oh, yeah.
Of, Stay Puft Marshmallows.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's lots of Ghostbusters. Like, there's lots of Stay Puft stuff.
Yeah. Good point. Karen Williams asks, when someone asks me if I'm a god, what should I say?
Yes.
I really like Winston's delivery there. When someone asks if you're a god, say yes. Like, just very, very sharp. Very, you know,
yeah,
really enjoy it.
Best line in the film and one of the best lines.
Yeah. Shane Welker asks, where do these stairs go? They go up.
They go up.
They go up.
That's and, great. Another one is made into the vernacular.
Yeah. And Natty P asks, is a sequel completely out of the question? I think we covered
that.
And
I say yes.
Yes.
But everybody else says no.
We'll see how that goes. Like I say, I am skeptical, but we will see. Mm. One final question. It is an audio question. I've heard this ahead of time. I don't think you guys are going to be able to answer it anyway, but let's... It's definitely a good question. It's definitely not just one of the flip questions. Like, this is from Bob, Mark Bosco, and he actually put some thought into this. Incidentally, Mark Bosco is a dead ringer for Cartoon Egon. Swear to Christ.
He's got that tornado of blonde hair, huh?
He does.
Hey, Alan, Matt, and guest. This is Bob. Do you guys remember when the Ghostbusters came out in 1984, they had the commercial, you know, the actual commercial that they used in the movie when Dana walks into her apartment and the TV's on real loud and Lewis had tried to walk out on a ledge to see if he could turn it down, but then he turned his up real loud. Anyway, that ad, they aired it on real TV and it had, I can't remember, it was either an 800 and special 900 number that you could call and hear a message from the Ghostbusters. And I remember I got permission from my mom to call it. And I remember fuck all about what was actually in the message. Do you guys remember that? That's real, right? I'm not just like hallucinating that. Cause maybe I'm having just trouble wording it for Google to understand it, but I'm not finding anything about it. It's kind of weirding me out.
All right, so I'm guessing you guys don't remember 1984, but maybe I'm wrong there.
I don't remember 1984, but I do remember that.
Yeah, because I actually read about it during my searches.
Ah, nice.
They said it was a real number, and not only could you call it, basically you called it, and they would say, like, give you just some throwaway, like, we're out busting ghosts right now. But it was, like, a real number, and... Mm-hmm.
It was Aykroyd and Murray, though, doing it. I don't
really? So they did some pre-recorded messages. That was a big thing. I don't know if you guys remember being, you know, as young as you were then, in the mid-80s to say early 90s, those 900 numbers, and they weren't like $5.95 for the first minute, blah, blah, whatever. They were 50 cents a call. And you call and get a pre-recorded message from all kinds of stuff. Like every TV show had one. So.
This is on IMDb. In the middle of the film's initial release, to keep interest going, Ivan Reitman had a trailer run, which was basically the commercial the Ghostbusters use in the movie, but with a 555 number replaced with a 1-800 number, allowing people to call. They got a recorded message of Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd saying something to the effect of, "Hi, we're out catching ghosts right now." They got 1,000 calls per day, 24 hours a day for 6 weeks.
Nice. Well, and something, unfortunately, we didn't mention when we were talking about the pre-production. I remember hearing that when these guys were running around New York and all that, they had the logo on everything, but they didn't tell anybody what it was. One of the very first kind of viral, like word of mouth kind of.
Well, not only that, the viral campaign was they were just slapping up posters saying, "Who are you going to call?"
Right.
It says, "Who are you going to call?" And then the poster slapped up there, which reminds me, "Who are you going to call?" is never said in the film, but it's in the song, obviously.
Right.
And, have you seen the music video for the song?
Yes.
A very young Jeffrey Tambor shows up and says, "Who are you going to call?" at one point.
Very nice.
And it's really weird. It's just like, here's this cavalcade of odd celebrities that Ray Parker Jr. could get at last second.
Including Norm from Cheers, if I recall.
Yes.
Hey, that was a good year to be George Wendt, let me tell you. All right, guys, like I say, really, we could talk about this for hours. And unfortunately, you know, we're going to lose the few listeners that we have for these theme shows if we do that. So we're going to have to draw this to a close. Any final thoughts? Anything we didn't cover that
Thank
we really need
very,
to?
Thank you very much for allowing me to do this. I know Matt, you know, is more than not grateful. I mean, he demanded this happen.
Yeah.
The show or whatever. But I appreciate you guys came to me because this has, you know, been my life. I love this show.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'll be honest. My first choice would have been Bosco just because when we were growing up, he loved it. But he already did the Back to the Future show. And after that, you were absolutely like, no, Adrian. I mean,
I'm glad to be your number two choice.
Well, but I'm telling you, my friend for the last 20 years was my first choice. So it's not like, you know, I guess Adrian will do. Like, no, it was let's give somebody else a chance and Adrian would be fucking awesome. And seriously, you know, you brought it. You did your homework. You dug up shit I'd never heard of and stuff that Matt wasn't even aware of, and that's, you know.
Which is pretty staggering in and of itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, take that in, Casey. Wrong.
Fantastic. All right, well, unfortunately, we got to wrap this up, so guys, thanks. And that's it. We're going to stop talking now.
The Sarcastic Voyage podcast is published every Tuesday and Friday and is available via iTunes or on the web at sarcasticvoyage.com. Detailed show notes, related links, and alternate file formats are also available on the web. That website, again, is sarcasticvoyage.com. Follow Matt and Al on Twitter. They are, respectively, @RobotMatt and @Algar. Listener feedback can be sent to podcast@algar.com. An on-air response is guaranteed. All material contained herein is the intellectual property of Ron Algar Watt, Matt Robotham, and the featured guest, unless otherwise noted. The Sarcastic Voyage podcast is a trademark of Algar Productions, copyright 2010. He was a suburban child of the 70s. They're ready to believe you.